Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 181, Tsongkhapa's Kindness and the Four Keys of Selflessness.
My job is finished. Breathing and smiling, laughing, that's it.
You know, the guy who, you know, Eckhart Tolle, who saved his own life from suicide out of depression, he did that because the reason he was going to kill himself, if you know his work, that guy, is that the voice that was telling him he was no good and life was not worth it and the universe was horrible and blah, blah, blah. He might as well kill himself. It seemed like an absolute mandate to him. And the way he saved himself was somewhere he somehow intuitively, instinctively sensed at a deep level where he was close to killing himself, the way he tells it, at a deep level that voice was not absolute, that he didn't have to listen to it. So another voice, a critical voice, rose in him saying, why are you listening to this? This is not your absolute voice speaking from your absolute self. It's just a bad habit, bad trend. And you don't have to listen to it. So that's the discovery of relativity. Although he didn't put it in those terms because he doesn't know this. He didn't learn this. He thinks it's just he got into now. Now told him. I know the guy, we're friends. Or I explained this to him over pasta. In an Italian restaurant, best place to have a Dharma talk. And in between slurping pesto, spaghetti. He agreed. He claimed he's writing a book to say that there's different kinds of the now. If the now is captured within some kind of notion of materialism and nihilism, it becomes an escapist, psychotic now, although it's a bit of a relief to people, but then they get stuck in it. If the now is the infinite, if the now contains all causality from the infinite past of your evolution, and the fact that you and all beings are each other's mothers, and then the infinite future of your Buddhahood, it's like a much cooler now. Of a dead Mao, a dead American Mao. Dead Mouse Mao. Mao Zedong Mao. Actually, since this is Tsongkhapa's holiday and we're having a puja about that in an hour, we're going to light candles because it's a festival of candles in Tibet. It's Tibetan Hanukkah. Candle festival. And you know, the Jews thought they came from Ur, but they actually came from Tibet. So, actually, because they herded animals, you know, in Tibet, and they wanted them. Okay, never mind, that's a joke. So, Tsongkhapa's special thing, as a, you know, about enlightenment that actually annoyed some other Tibetan lamas, actually, and even may annoy people in general, was the total non-duality of enlightenment. And what is so important about that is, you see, you can have an experience of oneness. I think I mentioned it already in a talk yesterday, which I call the cheap oneness, where you go into something like that space-like equipoise samadhi, and you think that's enlightenment, because it's a big relief to get in it. And you may be guided by a philosophical naivete, let's say, or an intellectual naivete, where you think that a relative thing can find an absolute, and there are, which is the natural one. You know, Moses, you know, this bush, this like dumb bush, just like our dumb bushes, another dumb bush, told him, go tell Pharaoh and let my people go and everything. And Moses, you know, first he tried to be logical. He said, look, who are you? Oh, you're God. Okay, well, you go tell Pharaoh. You know, he might listen to you more than me. Which is what? That's a way to talk to a burning bush that's giving you orders. I question that. And then, and not only that, but then that bush says, no, I'm going to go tell Pharaoh not to agree with you. Oh, what? Why are you sending me? He might kill me. And so, you know, like, it's the whole story. So human beings think that's all very normal. You know, in 2001, remember that movie? Oh, yes. It's a big black stone, all beautifully carved, and rectangular. And they're all looking at it. That's the absolute. It's a big black stone. But that's a relative thing. You couldn't see it. Absolute means you can't relate to it. Absolute doesn't relate to the relative. Or it's not absolute. All the theologians, they say, God creates the world, but he's not related to it. The world is nothing, just everything is God. That's just asinine, irrational statements. They just say that because they're feeling absolute, you know, and they're up on the pulpit there. And that's their absolute ego projection, you follow me? So the royal reason of relativity, if you don't know that, that anything you can experience, because you experience it, is relative. Okay? You cannot, a relative being cannot experience the absolute. It's impossible. Or it's not absolute. Okay? But all that the absolute is, in a way, therefore, is the negation of any relative absolute. You could say. That's what emptiness is, or freedom is. You can't find freedom, but you can be free from something. But freedom itself as an absolute is just a negation.
Well, I thought that since we're all in a happy mood, we would look a little bit at this issue of emptiness and selflessness. So I think we go into meditative mode. And there's a, especially today, I think, in honor of, since today is the death day of Tsongkhapa, which is considered a very, did I already tell the story about him, his enlightenment, two enlightenments? Did I already tell that?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes?
I did. 21 years, and so I already told that story.
To half the group.
What?
You told it to half the group.
Yeah, so he attained full enlightenment in 1398, but he waited 21 years to manifest in a certain way with the whole body in order to keep his monkhood. And he didn't want to be like a male female like that, because then all young Tibetan monks would run off and nuns, and they'd find boyfriends and girlfriends and claim that they were doing some enlightenment. And so he waited 21 years, and then so therefore his death day, which is the 25th day of the 10th lunar month, which is today, this year, he attained enlightenment in the Bardo, that physical enlightenment, and it was witnessed by all of his present disciples. I'm just looking at his biography. And so it's considered a very happy day, not at all a sad day, although he left his coarse body or his ordinary body at that time, and he moved to the Tushita heaven. And he also did an unusual thing where his disciples begged him to have a reincarnation to continue to lead the new community, the growing new community of the Ganden community, but joyous community it was called. And but he refused, and he said rather he wanted the head of the community to always be elected based on the community's judgment of who was the wisest and the most kind and the most compassionate and the best teacher. And so he wasn't going to reincarnate as a leader. He said if he did reincarnate somewhere, he wouldn't let on to them. He wanted to take a break. And it's believed that he is in the Tushita heaven in the Dharma center of Maitreya Buddha there, Bodhisattva, who's going to be next Buddha. And he teaches Madhyamaka there. So Madhyamaka meaning the central way.
of selflessness and emptiness.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. As we heard in the first half of this week's episode, Bob began after Dr. Nita led a great meditation on the Happy Mantra chant. If you want to catch the video that goes with this podcast, look in the podcast description. There's a great video with Dr. Nita opening this retreat. The recording comes from the Tibet House Menla Archives, and it was from the inaugural Medicine Buddha Longevity Retreat with Dr. Nita. It was a great time a couple years ago where we had Dr. Nita, Dr. Mark, Dr. Issa, Pagya Brimpache, and a bunch of different friends, including Eric Rosenbusch, all within about a month span. If you look at the Tibet House Archives on YouTube, there's some classic videos from that weekend. This episode's drawn from those archives. The recording of this podcast coincided with Lama Tsongkhapa Day, which is the 25th day of the 10th month on the Tibetan calendar. So Professor Thurman details what exactly happens on a Lama Tsongkhapa Day, and if memory serves me correctly, Professor Thurman was doing research for his newest edition of Wisdom publication, The Life and Teachings of Tsongkhapa. So this episode is a deep dive into the background of Tsongkhapa, his history, his teachings, and how his wisdom impacted the larger school of teachings we know as Tibetan Buddhism. Hope you'll enjoy this episode. He really helps make the history of Lama Tsongkhapa memorable and easy to understand, especially for those that are not familiar with this great teacher. And the second half is a guided meditation known as the Four Keys of Selflessness, which Bob has detailed in other podcasts and mentioned in other teachings. Hope you enjoy this meditation. We're awfully proud to be presenting it to you today. We will be producing a podcast extra where this entire day's retreat will be made available in audio form. Stay tuned for that. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Benefits include special invites to tours around the world with Robert Thurman and friends with Geographic Expedition. All trips benefit the work of Tibet House U.S. and Menla Retreat in Phoenicia, New York. Trips in 2019 include Sri Lanka. As always, the weekly interstitial music is provided by our dear friend, Tenzin Chogyal. To hear more from Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and the second half of this week's episode.
So in that honor, I thought we would just taste this meditation. Some of you may not have heard of it. And some of you may not have heard of what are called the four keys of the meditation on selflessness. When there are two kinds of selflessness, which is the same thing as emptiness. as a description of ultimate reality, and it does not mean that you do not have a self, that you do not exist. What it means is that you do not have a fixed, independent, intrinsically real self. You have a relational, constantly changing self or identity, but not a fixed one that's independent of relationships. That's what selflessness means. So then assert that as a pretty simply understandable logical thing, in the sense that if it's yourself, and therefore it's the one who experiences things that you experience, then it has to constantly change because your experiences are constant changing. And the idea that there's an unchanging witness in there that sees all these changing things without changing is, of course, simply an irrational assertion, because you can't see something without the process of seeing changing you. And we can, that's common sense only. You don't see it if you don't change. So let's meditate together now on these four keys. And Buddha was, I love Buddha because he said, I realized my selflessness and I feel so happy. My relative self is so happy to be free of living in the prison cage of my presumed absolute self that I thought I had. And so I therefore proclaim the insight of selflessness or emptiness, that I myself am empty of any absolute, unchanging, fixed identity self. And I proclaim that. But I'm not asking you to simply dogmatically believe that and go around and say selfless, selfless, and feel that you've sort of solved it by repeating that mantra, anatma. I don't want you to do that. Because actually, I know that you don't feel that way. You do feel that there's something in the very core of your own subjectivity, unless you're enlightened already, that there's something that never changes, that's always you, and it sort of provides, you think, your continuity through the years and through different experiences. There's one unchanging thing that's always there, is the you, the me, the real me. That's what we do think. And so I know that when I say selflessness, those who have that identity habit, as we call it, self-identity habit, feel it as a challenge, actually, rather than as something they can just grab onto. If you just grab onto it without experience, it will almost make you nihilistic, actually. You'll think that you don't exist, or something like that. That your real self is your non-existence, because you so strongly have that habit. Okay? So now the first key. Now meditate. You already did the breathing, so you're calm and you're concentrated. So the first key is a very strange one, very surprising one. It's called identifying the negandum, that which is to be negated, and which is negated by the expression selflessness or non-self. In other words, that's a negation, and it negates some kind of self. So in order to understand a negation, you have to understand what is being negated. And so the first key is identifying what is being negated by selflessness. In order to do that, you have to use your memory. You have to remember a time in your history, which probably isn't too hard, when someone falsely accused you of something. Not when they accused you when you did it, when you really did it, but when they falsely did by mistake. They think you did something, but they're perhaps annoyed about, and they accuse you of that. You did so-and-so. What did you do with my whatever it was? Or why did you do that? And they go like that. And emotionally, of course, it's very strong when someone you care about falsely accuses you. And you go through a cycle. When you're falsely accused, you go through a cycle where first you are kind of the injured innocent, and the second, you are the righteously indignant. And then eventually you become, if they keep accusing, you become angrily indignant, righteously angry, and righteously right, okay? But those later phases of that cycle are not what this meditation wants you to remember. It wants you to remember the first moment of when you were injured innocent. You know you didn't do it. And yet this person is insisting that you did. And so before you kind of protest even to them, you're kind of like, how could they think I would do that? And you're sort of checking that you didn't do it. And you're just in a state of incredulity that they would blame you in such a way when you're so innocent. And then there's a further trick in this key beginning of the meditation on selflessness, personal selflessness. And that trick is where you're remembering cognition, memory cognition, should be a small fraction of your consciousness, as if you were observing yourself in the memory from a hiding place, like spying on yourself, looking through a curtain. And your main consciousness should be re-inhabiting the memory and trying to feel how you felt and really getting into it, like a method actor or something, really feeling the feelings of injured innocence. Okay? So that's the exercise, that's the meditation. And the 11th Dalai Lama wrote that you need to spend about 6 months on this one. Or at least 6 weeks. And we don't really have that time. So, let me just say that when you succeed in this meditation is when you encounter within your sort of emotional and conceptual self, that feeling that you felt of pure innocence and also misunderstood innocence and injured, hurt feeling innocence, and the innocent you that you felt you were feels like it's undeniably innocent and undeniably solidly there. Maybe somewhere in your solar plexus, in your heart or chest. And feelings come up like a hot feeling, like a feeling of heat, sort of like embarrassment, sort of not too different from shame or embarrassment, flush of that, or the first flush before you get angry, flush of frustration. And that flush of the injured innocent, the hurt feeling innocent, feels as if it comes from the real you place. And they say you have succeeded in this key of identifying that which is negated by selflessness when you realize that at a visceral level you do not agree with Buddha's statement that you're selfless. And you suddenly realize that he, instead of giving you some dogma or something, he's challenging you. Buddha, Nagarjuna, Manjushri, Tsongkhapa, whoever it is. The Buddha's teaching. You're being challenged. You're being challenged to consider that that very solid you that you feel inside is illusory. He says it doesn't exist the way you feel it exists. And you say, sorry, but it seems to me to be really, really solid. Solid me. I'm innocent. I didn't do it. Don't say I did it. Don't think that. Etc. That I of protest that arises from the hurt feeling seems to come from it be rooted in an absolute place that is the real you. So we don't have hours and weeks and months. So we're just rehearsing this. But you can, I hope, understand what I mean. It's very surprising. It's a special oral tradition coming from Tsongkhapa through the Dalai Lamas and the Panchen Lamas, especially. Very, very special tradition. But in all the Buddhist communities, it also is present, this particular teaching. So then when you realize that you have a debate going with Buddha about yourself, a very, very deep and vital debate, you then come to the second key. And the second key is called, well, it's called identification, it's called the ascertainment of logical pervasion, which I think doesn't mean much to us because we're not trained in that system of logic, although it has a technical meaning in English. What I like to call it is a commitment to conventional binarity or duality in the following sense. When you really feel the real you there in your habitual visceral feeling of being really me here, you then take up Buddha's challenge. You respect Buddha enough, however, to take up the challenge. And you then decide, okay, I don't agree and I don't feel selfless in that sense, but he says so. He says I am. That's how he sees it. So I will double check. I will look within to verify what I feel in my debate with Buddha. And in doing so, I should actually find, since I will put my total effort into it, because this is the most meaningful thing I can do in life, is discover really what I am. Double check how I feel I am is what I am. So I will put my full effort into it, of my real self. But if I fail to find that real self, I then will deal with the implications of that failure. I will not waffle around and go for some third option, well, maybe I'm there, maybe I'm not there. I won't do what I wouldn't do about in conventional reality where there's a yes or no situation. If I can't come up with a yes, solid yes, with my full effort, then I have to go for no. And I make a commitment ahead of time to that. That's the second key. Again, very surprising. It's like kind of the law of excluded middle, which is the way the conventional habitual mind works. The reason for it perhaps being that when you go deep inside in this way, all kinds of strange corridors are there, and rooms, and funny byways. So you want to come out with the result in a practical way. And that's the reason for the second key. And avoid being trapped in some sort of weird, mysterious byway. Then there are various, sometimes there's four more keys, or five, a total of seven. Sometimes there's two, sometimes there's only one. But first, let's meditate on the two. So the first one is that I feel that real Bob is here in me. So real Bob is going to double check to verify this. So how do I do that? I examine myself. I look through it all. And the Buddhist tradition has given me a scheme known as the five psychophysical processes, or literally the five heaps. Skandhas is the Sanskrit word. It literally means a pile or a heap. But we'll call them processes. And these are the material process of my body and nervous system, etc. Then there's the sensational process of my sensations of pleasure, pain, or numbness, which is the first coarsest level of mind connected with the material processes. Then there's my conceptual process, flow of ideas and images in my mind. Then there's the emotional process, flow of reactions to those ideas and those sensations, my emotions of suffering or joy or whatever it might be. And finally, there's my consciousness itself, my awareness of all those processes. So five process levels of process, starting with the most obvious one, which is the body. Now, since I did my first key more thoroughly than we've been able to do this afternoon, I recognize that when I felt I am innocent, all these many times I've been accused in my life of things that I didn't do, it feels like that I is almost physical. You know, when the flush of heat, of embarrassment, of hurt feelings, of shame, of righteousness, of anger, when those energies arise from my guts, from my heart, my solar plexus, it seems as if they come from a real physical place. I have recognized by now. So now I look inside my physical aggregate to find that place. I can go through all my nervous system. I look in my, whatever image I have of my anatomy. I go into my heart center. I go in my brain. And depending on how sophisticated it is, then maybe I go into the atoms that make up my heart and my brain. Then I get into wave-particle paradox if I do quantum. And even those particles dissolve under analysis, disappear into waves. So, pretty soon, I come up with a puzzling result that I can't find some little bob in there. A little bob template, a little bob node, a little homunculus. It's easy for us in modern time because materialistic science has analyzed matter very thoroughly, and it has dissolved under their analysis actually since 1926. So that's helpful to us actually. So we say, okay, it's got to be in the mind and not in the body. So then I look, then again, when I felt I'm innocent and I'm hurt, that was a kind of sensation. I felt it was unpleasant. So then I look into that memory carefully, because it's vivid in my mind if I've done the first key strongly. And then, you know, when you look at any sensation that you have, like even a sharp pain, you stick yourself with a point of something, sharp little pain, but if you meditate on that little sharp pain, it sort of gets diffused and you can't find the absolute point of the pain. You know, if you use your mindfulness and look at it carefully, you can't find it. You know, so the sensation of I, where the I seemed to come from as a sensation, you can't find one sensation that was Bob Thurman's. So you reject that your real self is a sensation. It's not at that level of mind, pretty quickly. Then the conceptual level of process is a little more complicated because you have a name, Bob, whatever your own name is. If someone looks at you and calls you by a wrong name, you have that odd feeling that it doesn't sort of hit you. They're summoning call. And you kind of look behind yourself, who are they talking to? Or you'll correct them, that what your real name is. But if they look at you and summon your attention in some way by repeating your actual name, it feels like it mobilizes from your, you get fully mobilized, you engage. So it seems to hit you. But where does it hit, Bob? Are you really Bob? Or whatever your name is, Jason. Or whatever your name happens to be. So you start then, Bob itself, where's the Bob? Is it in the B, the O, and the B? Is it in the written form, B-O-B in English letters? You could write Bob in Devanagari, Bob, not O, Bob, Bob, Bob. They all look different. So it doesn't, the name doesn't seem to be the real me, actually, since I could have different names. But it takes a little analysis to overcome the feeling of, you know, like that somewhere hanging on your heart is a little charm bracelet, one of those little necklaces that high school kids wear with their name woven on it. And then a picture of yourself, if you have, like what you look like in the mirror, or what you did look like in the mirror at the time you had that feeling, is that the real you? That image. Because that's part of the conceptual I read, are images, not just words. And then which picture, and from what angle, and your whole body, or just your face, etc. And your face at which moment, and what expression, when Gela has just tickled you with the ah-ah, chitta, sukha, sam-sam. Or when you're looking solemn, or what? And you're being photographed for your passport. So pretty soon all the images you have of yourself become relative, and there's no real image of yourself you can't find. So you reject that that solid thing you feel in there is actually simply a concept. But a real concept, or the referent of a real concept. You reject that. Then the emotion of I'm injured innocent, I have hurt feelings, I'm righteously indignant, and even I'm angry and self-righteous, and all of those emotions, they are all completely fluctuating, changing. They sort of seem to come from a real place, but none of them are fixed. They just rise and fall. They mobilize all kinds of hormones and, you know, feelings of heat, hot and cold in your body, but they can't be a fixed absolute you, any of them. So you reject that aggregate. Finally, you come to consciousness aggregate. Then consciousness aggregate is a little bit complicated too. At first it seems, oh yeah, good, that's just my consciousness. But you can then divide that into six when you become self-analytical about your consciousness. Because you have visual consciousness, audio consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, tactile consciousness that goes along with your skin and your surfaces. And they're very complicated. They're always changing depending on the stimulus from your environment. And then there's a sixth consciousness, the way the Buddhists understand, called mental consciousness. And it quite often is aligned with one of the sense consciousnesses, therefore always changing by paying attention to what you're seeing, changing by paying attention to what you're smelling, or touching, or see, or hearing, etc. And they're always changing. Then you can have inner imaginative objects, mental objects in your mind. Like you can visualize the Washington Monument, the Potala Palace, the face of your loved one, the medicine Buddha. And so you can have mental images in your consciousness. And your mental consciousness changes depending on which image you have in the mind. But there must be one that doesn't change, because I feel as if it's always me, Bob, having that experience. So then you come to the most difficult part of this meditation, the most important one, where you turn your subjectivity around on your subjectivity. So you try to observe yourself observing. And for this to really succeed in this, you have to have quite a good degree of concentration, because the mind will veer off It's much harder to hold your mind on this than it is on your breath or on a mantra or on an image of Buddha. It's very difficult to hold the mind focusing on the mind, drilling down, so to speak, into your subjectivity, with your subjectivity. And you drill down toward that feeling that you had identified, that you really are innocent, and that's the real unchanging you, the independent self-identity. Identity means always the same. Idem in Latin means the same, identity. And you have this strange, actually, if you do it strongly and you have concentration, it becomes nauseating. You become very uncomfortable. You become dizzy because you're sort of turning the root of your subjectivity on the root of your subjectivity. And then each time you turn it, it seems to, like a dog's tail when it whirls around to catch its tail, it seems to swivel out of your purview, away from your observation, and yet it's still observing. So it's like it's honing in on this thing that around the corner you still think is very solid. But every time you get to the corner and look for it, it's sort of around the corner behind you. So you're kind of jumping from corner to corner, twisting like a dog, drilling. This becomes like what they call the diamond cutting drill, if you have that concentration level, which is quite a strong one. And what eventually happens is like you have a kind of experience like you have a diamond held in a vice grip, and you have a drill press of a diamond tipped drill bit, and that which drill press is your concentration. And the pressure of the bit of the and the swirling of the drill bit is your critical insight, your vipassana, your transcendent insight. And you're pressuring diamond against diamond. And it's spinning, each one is equally hard, so they're spinning and spinning. And you don't want them, but eventually the drill press and the drill vise start to evaporate. And the two diamonds produce kind of light and heat, searing like white hot heat, and which melts everything around it. And what happened if you can sustain it, which is, you know, this, I say we're rehearsing this, but you can imagine this perhaps in the rehearsal. If you sustain it, what happens is that everything melts in the universe, but at a certain point, but these two diamonds bearing on the diamond, drilling on each other, and then they finally dissolve into a luminous space like equipoise, as they call it. And that means at this point you have entered what is called the space-like equipoised samadhi of selflessness. And you have a feeling of tremendous release, tremendous relief. And there's a little danger here. And the danger is that you will think that, oh, this selfless state is myself. It's my reality. So my reality is just a space with nothing in it. Unfortunately, people have made this mistake. They think that this space is emptiness or selflessness, which it is not, actually. Because selflessness means only the absence of an absolute self, not the absence of a relative self. Because it's the relative self that experiences this sense of selflessness. And so the momentum of pressure, of inquiry, of penetrating insight, critical insight, continues without verbalization, without effort, without thought, because you've achieved a concentration to achieve this. You have a high degree of concentration. And what happens is the space-like state of relief although one can indulge in it for a while. But it itself dissolves. The inquiry thing is no longer looking for the hard rock of the self in oneself. It's exploring this vast space, which you've dissolved. So it's not something that you're not like you're floating in a space and then you think, I'm going to look around the space. It's just that your awareness looks around this feeling of infinity. And when it looks at infinity, it realizes that the infinity itself is also not absolute. It was only a relational state to having thought that there was this finite thing you were going to catch. And in a way, it's a kind of a failure of the catching the finite state. My great Lama Taratoko put it beautifully. He said, what it is your relative self has been so long imprisoned and entwined with the cancer of an assumed absolute self that you simply assumed was it. That when the absolute self disappears, it takes the relative self with it, temporarily. Unless the relative self is not aware of what's called the royal reason of relativity, of the emptiness of emptiness, the deepest level of emptiness, or the shallowest level of emptiness. That emptiness also is empty. And what happens when the space disappears? When the space disappears, you're back amongst all of the differentiated objects. You're back as a separated subjectivity who had an experience of disappearing into a vast luminous space, which was a big gas, a pleasant experience, a relief. But that relief itself is not an absolute state. It was a relative state. It's the realization of the emptiness of emptiness. And so then, and what's important is that the differentiated things, this is called entering the dreamlike aftermath samadhi, or the illusion-like aftermath samadhi, where interacting with relational things becomes a samadhi, a meditation. And why is it illusion-like? Not because things look like rainbows, necessarily. They might, to someone with a certain affinity and karma, but it does not. Mainly, things look also as if they were sort of really real again, and then you feel like, oh darn, I let go of the self, and I was feeling so released, and now I seem to be really here again. But I thought I discovered I wasn't really here. My unreal self discovered that the real one was an illusion, but now this illusion seems to be back. That's why. It's illusory. So then, you know, you have this double consciousness. You finally become cured of being a helpless victim of your own ignorance. Because you have a balancing consciousness. A cognitive dissonance tolerant consciousness. In the following sense. The best analogy, inexpressible actually, I mean, I can't say anything to describe it. It's inexpressible, but the analogy will be very helpful. When you look in a mirror, like you see your face in a mirror, it looks like you're in the mirror. The room behind you looks like another room in the mirror. It's illusory in that sense. It looks like a three-dimensional space in the mirror, and there's your face there. But you know, without thinking, at a subliminal intuitive level, that you're not that face in the mirror. It's merely a reflection of yourself, of your face, in three-dimensional, habitual, relative reality. Right? You know that simultaneously. So that simultaneous knowledge, without thinking twice, corrects a tendency to grab into the mirror, like put your eyeliner on the face in the mirror, shave the face in the mirror, whatever. Reach in there to do something. It immediately corrects that, so you're not taken in by the illusion. So once you achieve the space-like equipoise samadhi of selflessness and return to the illusion-like aftermath samadhi, the space-like equipoise samadhi, memory of it, becomes like the subliminal knowledge that the whole of reality is only a reflection in the mirror of clear light of the void, of transparency of voidness, which a synonym of which could be simply freedom. Freedom is also a negation. People don't realize, they think, freedom, I want freedom. But freedom is actually a negation. It means being free of something. So it's also a negation. So it could be translated emptiness, actually. Free of intrinsic identity. Freedom from intrinsic identity, you would say. Empty of intrinsic identity. They're like virtually the same. So that is a really good analogy. But of course, at first, if you only had that space-like equipoise samadhi one time, in the conclusion of one kind of inquiry meditation, then the sense of it, the mirrorness, is not so strong as the tendency to begin grasping after the differentiated objects and grasping at yourself as the differentiated, alienated subject. Like, because your ignorance habit is still very strong, and your wisdom habit, the cognitive dissonance, paradox, tolerating habit is not strengthened. So you have to repeat this kind of thing. That's why it takes a long time. It's a gradual process, really. There are momentary satori's, breakthroughs, but which are could be quite powerful, but it's a longer-term process, like melting butter in the broth, the great Atisha said, or like ironing the wrinkles out of a cotton cloth with the ironing hot stone. Slow, gradual process. Repeating this kind of meditative thought experiment again and again. But it's lovely, the term is so lovely, the dream-like aftermath samadhi. Because once you know that whatever it is that you feel is the most solid things, the most intrinsically real things around you, the most absolute things around you, that people live and die over, actually. So the sense of misplaced absoluteness is really powerful. You know, religious fanatics, or ideological communist fanatics, or capitalist fanatics, or whatever, you know, egotistical fanatics, psychotics, they all think there's this absolute that's the real them, or the real thing that they want, or the person that they hate, you know. And they all absolutize all these things, and then they act all completely, relationally destructive. Because they are not really fitting into relativity, because of these false concepts that they're imprisoned by. So it's a huge relief to first even discover the first one is not really the way it seems. That's what's called the balm or the medicine, the elixir of emptiness. It's an elixir that heals and soothes the sharp edges of misplaced absolutisms, of self and things. And it's the foundation of all of those things. You then realize that you are imagining yourself like you do in a dream, even in a wake. And that is not a crippling or a threatening thing when you realize it. What it is a liberating thing. It becomes an opportunity to reimagine yourself. And it becomes there's a warning of not letting yourself be imagined by authorities, by tradition, by others, you know, to create yourself carefully, systematically, and use the technologies of self-creation that exist, that the enlightened beings have left for us out of their kindness.
Yes,
See?
Thank you, Bob. Thank you.
If you haven't heard of Diane DePrima, where have you been living? She's been in my life for 50 years, and I'm grateful to be in hers. She's the author of 40 books, including Memoirs of a Beatnik, Recollections of My Life as a Woman, Loba, the epic poem, and Allen Ginsberg says of her, Diane DePrima, revolutionary activist of the 1960s beat literary renaissance, heroic in life and poetics, a learned, humorous bohemian, classically educated and 20th century radical, her writing, informed by Buddhist equanimity, is exemplary in imagist, political, and mystical modes. She broke barriers of race class identity, delivered a major body of verse, brilliant in its particularity. These are three Dharma poems. One, his vision or not? Gone is the authority with which he opened his fan. His vision or not? Gone is the authority with which he opened his fan. Two. Raindrops melt in the pond, and it's hard to say just what lineage is. Three. My faith, what is it but the ancient dreams of wild ones in the mountains? Third poem. I fail as a Dharma teacher. I don't imagine I'll manage to express sunyata in a way that all my students will know and love, or present the Four Noble Truths so they look delicious and tempting as Easter candy. My skillful means is more like a 2x4 banging on the head of a reluctant diver. I then go in and save. What pyrotechnics! Alas, this life, I can't be kind and persuasive. Slip the 12-part chain off hundreds of shackled housewives. Present the Eightfold Path like the ultimate roadmap at all the gas stations in Samsara. But, oh, my lamas, I want to. How I want to. Just to see your old eyes shine in this Kali Yuga, stars going out around us like birthday candles. Your empty, clear, luminous, and unobstructed rainbow bodies swimming in and through us like transparent fish. I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.